We've heard about, in the last day and a half, about exotic quantum phases and exotic quantum phase transitions. I hope this will be a good talk, but I'm afraid there are no hedgehogs, no loops, no webs, not even noodle soup. But what I do hope to show you is that if you're in an exotic state, as represented this time by a spin liquid, the nonlinear dynamics permit you exquisite sensitivity to what the state is, and also the ability to see what the states around you are. This work was led by Sayantani Ghosh, who's here. She's a postdoc at Santa Barbara now with David Al-Shalam, and was done in collaboration with Gabe Epley. We also did some modest simulations, which I'll tell you about, in conjunction with Sue Coppersmith, who's now at Wisconsin. So as Radu Kadea told you, spin liquids have interesting collective behavior. They also are often perched between different competing order parameters, and it's those transitions that I'm interested in talking about today using nonlinear dynamics. I want to show you that you can use the nonlinear dynamics to encode information into the system, that this information takes the form of collective excitations that in fact are often quantum in nature and can be coherent for times of over seconds, and that indeed there is extreme sensitivity to the ground state of the system, and I'll show you that explicitly. No long-range order in a spin liquid as T goes to zero, however it doesn't freeze. It's not a spin glass, but it's not simply a paramagnet with individual spins, but rather their short-range correlations between these spins. That's the collective behavior I was referring to. What prevents freezing? There can be a number of reasons a system won't freeze even as you cool it to zero temperature. One is geometric frustration. We saw a good example of that in the 2D case in cesium copper chloride. Quantum fluctuations is another possibility that's been much discussed in these sessions. Also, of course, reduced dimensionality by itself. I'm going to talk about two cases. One is a non-disordered but geometrically frustrated system in 3D, gadolinium gallium garnet, GGG. The second is a system whose liquid state is stabilized by quantum fluctuations. That's lithium holmium-yttrium fluoride. That means they're short-range correlations. The individuals you're not described, for example, the susceptibility is non-Curie-like. I'll show you that. So they're short-range correlations, or if you do neutron scattering, you see a liquid structure factor. Lithium holmium yttrium fluoride is an insulating system. You can buy single crystal rods this big that are used for lasing. It's just money that you have to pay, depending on the size, but we buy them on Christmas sale, actually. You can think of the lithium fluoride lattice holds the holmium spins, which are the magnetic entity, far enough apart that they interact primarily as dipoles. So you have a dipolar system, and the crystal fields are such that the holmium points only along the C-axis, so it has Ising spin symmetry. The ground state doublet is 10 Kelvin below the first excited state, so at the temperatures I'll be talking about, which is the low temperature regime, you really have this good Ising symmetry where the spins are in this ground state. Depending on the concentration of holmium spins, you can get different states. You can dilute with yttrium as you substitute a magnetically inert species on the holmium site. And the nice thing here is that it does not distort the lattice structure, at least to the 0.01% level, so there's no tendency towards clustering. So you can really think of the holmium spins when this is disordered, diluted, as being thrown in randomly in space. The pure system, lithium holmium fluoride, is an Ising ferromagnet with a TC of 1.5 Kelvin. It's 1.5 Kelvin, not 1,000 Kelvin like iron, because it's the dipolar interaction, not an exchange interaction. You can dilute it down to about half, and you keep the long-range order, but you get some classy behavior as the domains relax in a very slow fashion. The TC is suppressed linearly with X because you have a 1 over R cubed interaction, and of course an R cubed system in 3D. By about 2/10 of a 2/10 of the sites, 20% of the sites occupied by the magnetic species. The fact that the nearest neighbor interaction is ferromagnetic, the second nearest neighbor interaction is antiferromagnetic, gives you competition, frustration combined with the disorder that gives you a spin glass state. But it turns out that if you dilute further, in fact, down to about 5% of the sites occupied, you kill the spin glass, and in fact, you get into a spin fluid state, apparently to the lowest temperatures, where the fluctuations arise from the fact that the dipolar interaction has a transverse field term. This transverse field term is now the Ising model in transverse field. Okay, which introduces quantum fluctuations into the system. And you might say, well, that's there all the time, they're dipoles. But of course, if you take a pure system, then any site here is going to have a transverse term from the spin next to it, canceled by the transverse term of the spin on the other side of it. So from the crystal symmetry, that's not an important effect. It's only, in fact, when you become dilute that you see this.
It's between half and one, the system is a ferromagnet at low temperature, right?
A ferromagnet?
Between half and one.
Yes, that's correct.
And this is just a percolation ferromagnet? I mean, what is the mechanism of the ferromagnet?
Well, Ludinger and Tizza showed that it, when you have competing ferromagnetic and anti-ferromagnetic interactions, which you get, of course, from the dipole distributions, the crystal lattice symmetry that gives you the answer. And it's basically because the nearest neighbor interaction is ferromagnetic that dominates. Okay, signatures, going back to Leo's point here, if you look at the DC susceptibility, so this is the magnetic susceptibility measured in the frequency goes to zero limit, you see down to, this is 1 Kelvin, so now going down to about 40 or 50 millikelvin, the susceptibility continues to grow without a peak in the susceptibility, no magnetic ordering, but it grows not as a pure Curie law, but with a sub-Curie temperature dependence. We saw this a bit with in Anders Sandvik's talk as well with random spin chains and 2D sorts of systems like that. This T to the minus alpha is known in a number of systems, doped semiconductors, also amorphous niobium silicon, coming from low energy excitations of the system and correlations between those systems, between those states. In this case, in fact, one can model it. One can do a real space renormalization type argument, this pairwise decimation that was done for 1D spin chains by Fisher and Descoopta and Ma earlier, also done then in doped semiconductors by Bott and Lee. If you do this only taking into account the axial component of the dipole interaction, that is only the part along the Ising axis, then as you consider your pairs, you have a degenerate ground state doublet and a first excited state doublet that's degenerate. And you get the Curie law, the deviation from the Curie law, because you have a mix now, because of the random distribution of the dipoles, of interaction energies J, and every time the J is greater than the temperature, you throw out that spin, or you renormalize it. If it's antiferromagnetic with zero moment, it gets thrown out. If it has a net moment, then it stays in the system, renormalized by position and moment, and you do the calculation lowering the temperature. If you do that with a fixed J here, and the splitting here is roughly the nearest neighbor interaction, then you find out, and I'll show you the data, you get nothing like you would expect. In fact, this thing freezes quite easily because this J is about a Kelvin. However, if you now put in the transverse term, you lead to a splitting of these states, so you have much more ability to keep relaxing, to keep contributing to the susceptibility down to the lowest temperatures. But it's not enough, in fact, just to split to get the level splitting. In fact, if you do the computation correctly, what's key is the fact that there's a mixture, an entanglement between the ferromagnetic states and the antiferromagnetic states.
The transverse field, you turning on yourself?
No, the transverse field, and we've done a lot of experiments looking with an external transverse field, but in this case, the transverse field is intrinsic. It comes from the fact that the dipolar interaction is anisotropic, has a horizontal component, right? It has a butterfly shape, 3 cos squared theta minus 1. Well, sure. I mean, that gives you the character, but you can calculate, you can simulate that exactly.
It's not quite a theory.
So I'll come back to what happens if you apply an external transverse field. We have some hints of that, but don't know in this system. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes, I was just saying, it's not quite a field, it's a square of the...
No, it's an actual magnetic field from one dipole acting on another.
It's an isotropic Heisenberg model.
Yeah.
Well, no, there's Ising spin symmetry, so there's now a transverse component there. Anisotropic, you're saying. Or anisotropic. Yes, anisotropic, right, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's not an exchange. There's no exchange term. They're far enough apart that you don't see it. Yes, this is a pairwise decimation. You could not do this calculation, for example, in the spin glass. If you do this simulation just using now the classical, the axial dipole, this is what you get for the susceptibility. Some of this irregularity here has to do with the fact that we're looking at the real lattice, so you get the sort of various shells here of the dipolar interaction. In fact, the specific heat looks something like this. You can measure that as well. You can smooth it out, though, the minute you put in the the transverse component. What I'm showing you here now is with the dipole, the finite transverse term, which is random, as Eugene points out. Let me note that there's no scaling of the data in the experiment here. This is using the real crystal lattice parameters that we know and the crystal field parameters from the simulation here. And this is the data that I showed you before that goes as t to the minus alpha.
The left-hand side is the theory.
The left-hand side is if I do the calculation. I'm sorry.
It's theory.
They're all theory. I mean, except for the red.
That were data.
The rest. So there are two simulations. One is this system. This is this configuration. One is this configuration applied to the actual situation. And the green and the black are simulation, and the right is experiment. Yes, that's correct. Okay, but there's more to learn by looking at the dynamics, not just the DC susceptibility. And what you see here is the imaginary part of the susceptibility as a function of log frequency, so this goes over 5 decades. You see that the peak of the response moves down, as you would expect, as you go to lower temperature. So the system, the average time slows down for the system as you cool it. But if you note, this is a rather broad spectrum, and if this would be a glassy system, what you would expect is it would broaden out as you go to lower temperatures, you get more and more barriers to relaxation. In fact, you see quite the opposite. You see that the shape here, not just the average time, but the shape now is changing, and the shape is in fact narrowing as you get to lower temperature. And if you look at 0.12, you see there's even a crossing now where this end is pulling in, the low frequency end is pulling in through the higher temperature data. So you might think of this narrowing, if you will, like an anti-glass. It's the opposite of what you expect for a glass. And you can see this in spades if you scale the data. So what I've done now is taken the peak position and scaled them together and the peak frequency to look at the evolution of the shape. And you see on the high frequency side, these are basically all doing the same, but on the low frequency end, you're getting a pull-in of this weight. And it's quite a sharp feature down at 50 millikelvin. Almost looks gap-like. The full width at half maximum at the lowest temperature is about 0.8 decades. And for the aficionados among you, this presents a major problem. The reason it's a problem is if you take the simple sort of theory, which is just a Debye width, a single relaxation time, then you expect the width at half maximum to be 1.14 decades. Now, in glasses, you often have multiple relaxation times. That's characteristic of glasses. You get different size clusters relaxing and so on and so forth. That broadens out the spectrum. However, it's hard to understand how you get less than one relaxation time if you're narrower than the Debye width. And so, in fact, you might think about this not as a relaxation spectrum, but rather as a convolution of a bunch of harmonic oscillators. So if that's true, And that's really what's giving you the physics of this response, of the dissipative response, then you might be able to access those harmonic oscillators in a kind of hole-burning experiment. So you know, with lasers, you zap things, and you flood the excited state, and you drill a hole in the spectrum, because now you no longer have excitations left in the ground state. So that's what we did. This is the hole burning. So the hole burning is you have a probe at a certain frequency that you're going to scan at a certain amplitude, and then you pump at a particular frequency with a much higher amplitude. And here you go. This is the curve now at 110 millikelvin. Here is a 5 hertz pump, and you can see you can drill out a nice hole in the spectrum, which corresponds then to excitations of the spins that respond to this 5 hertz. And it's a large number of spins. It's about 10 to the 17th per cubic centimeter of total, just by integrating under here and looking at the net that you're missing. This is about 1% of the total spins available. And these excitations now are labeled by frequency. I can pump at any frequency along here and drill out holes at that time. So it's not that 10 to the 17th spins per cubic centimeter, about a cubic centimeter sample, it's actually close, are going at once, but rather in different regions, there's small clusters of spins adding up that are presumably distributed spatially, but are labeled by frequency. And I'm accessing different sort of oscillations by different frequency. And let me remind you, this is not some complicated high-power laser experiment. This is taking a single crystal and wrapping a wire around it and picking up the sound. The signal. Okay, so that's all we're doing. You have to be very careful to be in the linear regime. That is, you start seeing nonlinear effects up much above 50, 60, 70 milliorsteds. So you're talking about very small fields. And also, there's some subtlety in terms of cooling down. You have to use a dilution refrigerator. You can also encode simultaneously in different parts of the spectrum. This is a blow up of the low frequency part of the spectrum. This is the poor man's way, so you don't buy a number of frequency generators. You put in a square wave, so of course you get omega 3, omega 5, omega 7, omega. I show you omega 3 hertz, and I also show you 3 omega here. In fact, the ratio of these two is roughly 3 to 1. I'm not showing you the fact that at 15 hertz, there's actually another hole that's burnt out there. So,
well, yes? Central position, somehow you decide these modes. And now they don't contribute to the...
Right, that if you have a two-level system, right, just a harmonic oscillator, you excite the what's in the ground state to the excited state, and so then when you're probing the equilibrium ground state response, it's no longer there. So that's a sort of view. Yeah, it's a bleaching experiment, exactly. That's all it is. You might ask now, what happens? Of course, I'm seeing these, and they're responding, and I'm sitting there, but what happens if I pump them up, and then I turn off the pump? And I ask, how long do these oscillations live? And that's what I've done here. You can see this is the time of the pump, and now I define my time equals zero when I turn it off, and this is the magnetization as a function of time along the Ising axis, and this is basically the ring down. So this is the envelope. The spins are now ringing down, and you can see that by down at around 70 millikelvin, I'm getting a 1 over E time of somewhere around 10 seconds. So these states, even when not being driven, stay together for a long time. It's in part because this is an ionic insulator, and the coupling to lattice is very poor. You can see here, this is this decay time here is a function of the frequency of the pump. There's a little kink here, which is where, in fact, the dissipation, the imaginary part of the susceptibility, goes to zero. So when you're in that regime, then you have far less dissipation. In fact, this time rises quite fast. And to give you a sense, even though these times are extremely long, note that these are relatively low frequencies, so we're talking about Qs of order 50. Okay, we're not talking about Qs of 10 to the 6th, unfortunately. Okay, what is it that's responding? And you can get some information of that from the magnetization. So this is the magnetization now as a function of the AC excitation field at 5 hertz. You see here's a nice linear response regime. You then go to the nonlinear response at high excitation. Note, this is half a Gauss. is the high excitation I'm talking about, so I'm not talking about really blasting this. This is at 5 hertz, so the fact that you have a DC field from the Earth at half a gauss is not relevant here. And so you can fit this curve here by a Brillouin fit, and if you do that, except now instead of just using one spin, you use a cluster of spins, then that's what the solid line is, and you can do this at different pump frequencies. And you can see you get numbers of spins in a cluster somewhere between 250 or 350 spins that are responding. And that, in fact, as you go to lower frequencies, you might expect you're exciting larger amount of spins that are going back and forth. The other kind of neat thing about this phase, which is a ratio of the imaginary to the real part of the susceptibility, comes down to zero in the high frequency regime, which means that the process is dissipationless or has tiny, very small dissipation, which is, corresponds to its long lifetime. So you might think about this in different language, like Rabi oscillations in atomic systems, where you're setting up now the excitations of these spin clusters that are connected by the internal transverse fields. And then when you're really at high amplitude, you're seeing basically a system that's dominated by some sort of inertial term because your dissipation is very small. Okay. Now you might ask, is this peculiar to lithium homeomerium fluoride, a system, a spin liquid that, after all, has a rather unique way of developing its spin liquid through these quantum fluctuations? Can you see these sorts of effects anywhere else? And so we looked at GGG, which is a geometrically frustrated magnet with now not Ising but Heisenberg spin symmetry. Yes.
Can you correlate the size of the cluster, the number of spins in a cluster extracted this, in terms of magnetization,
yes,
with the amount of depletion in the field?
You mean the fact that you're drilling how big the hole is with the number of spins? No, that doesn't seem to correlate. That's an amplitude effect. I mean, the only thing I can tell you about the number of spins is that in some sense they have to be that big, because you're sitting at 130 millikelvin and you have a G factor of 14 and you have half a gauss. And how do you get an effective energy that's of order 100 millikelvin? The only way you do that is getting a few hundred spins. And in fact, if you calculate it, you're at about 150 millikelvin. So in that sense, it's self-consistent. But in terms of how big the hole is, we don't see a direct correlation.
That N is presumably frequency dependent?
Yes, and that was the inset there where you saw, I mean, I can go back, but basically it starts at about 10 hertz or 15 hertz at 250 spins, and by half a hertz it's up to 350 spins.
You used the word spin cluster to describe.
Yes.
Do you have a mental image of what?
Yeah, this is a poor experimentalist ball and stick model. So yeah, I mean, you're dominated by the ferromagnetic interactions here, so my view is that, you know, you have a 6 by 6 by 6 sort of region of extended spins that are coupled ferromagnetically, and you're flipping them back and forth. They're distributed randomly through the system, adding up to 10 to the 17th. And as I change my frequency, I act as different sort of combinations of spins. That's my simple view of it. Yeah.
Little randomly placed magnet, basically. Each magnet is about 200 to 300 spins.
That's correct. That seems consistent with all the data, but of course we're not taking a picture, so you have to do that. Okay, these are antiferromagnetically connected, and the frustration comes from, of course, these corner sharing triangles here. And the spins can point in all directions, but of course there's equivalent energy for spins pointing like that or spins pointing like that, so the system finds it difficult to freeze. The phase diagram was mapped out in some very pretty experiments by Peter Schiffer and Art Ramirez, and you can see you have this claim of a spin liquid state here, freezing into a spin glass state down somewhere around 100 millikelvin or a little above. And then as you go up in field, this is just field, say, along 100, you wind up with this antiferromagnetic bubble, which actually has this funny curvature around here, which is like the melting curve of helium. So, however, there's some controversy about the nature of this phase diagram, and we want to use, in fact, the nonlinear excitations to talk about the phase diagram. This is neutron scattering. You see, and this is the sort of structure factor of fluids, or, you know, a bunch of hard spheres would look kind of like this. And you get that, in fact, 85% of the spin volume is unfrozen. But you notice that although there's some Bragg peaks growing up at low temperature, you still see this liquid structure factor. So the claim is, in fact, this remains liquid with some superimposed order on it, even at the lowest temperatures. And that picture is also supported by muon spin relaxation.
What's this microscopic moment?
It's acts like a spin half with a G factor of 14. I mean, gadolinium, or 12, something like that. I mean, you know, these are rare earths, so it's like these magnets that stick to your refrigerator these days. What do you see in the dynamic susceptibility? You see here, these are curves now going from 500 millikelvin down to 110 millikelvin. This is now a Heisenberg system, so they're all riding on this bath of low-level excitations as opposed to the Ising system. So these curves are somewhat different shape because of this background. But you can see that you get, you know, a relatively broad distribution. This is only over two decades here. And then at around 110 millikelvin, you get a flattening out of the low-frequency response. And this flattening out of the low-frequency response is characteristic of a spin glass, or some sort of frozen disordered state. If this continues all the way down in frequency, then this is equivalent to 1 over F noise in the magnetization. If you look now in the region around where you expect spin glass freezing, you see this is a blow up now, 110, 190, 75, 50 millikelvin. You see this nice flattening out. It continues, but then, lo and behold, at the lowest temperatures on the other side of where the spin glass is, just like the neutrons show, there's still, you seem to recover the sort of shape that you had before. Okay, so the susceptibility looks funny. So you might go back to this phase diagram and ask, well, is there some sort of ordered state with Bragg peaks or a spin glass type state just in a dome around here? And so you can compare the nonlinear response in this regime, the spin liquid regime, and in the so-called frozen regime, and see if there's any difference. And in fact, this turns out to be a powerful tool, very sensitive to where you are in the phase diagram. This is in the liquid, so you can see you can burn nice holes again at a variety of frequencies. So this hole burning, this encoding, is not restricted to lithium homium fluoride, a quantum fluctuation spin liquid. You see it in a frustrated system without disorder as well. But now if I go into the glass state, so this is 200 millikelvin, 100 millikelvin, you can't do it. So if you get into this state, which has a different sort of dynamic susceptibility, in fact, you're not able to burn holes. And you see in conventional spin glasses, it's very difficult to burn holes except by heating yourself out of the state and then coming back. Okay, so you might now ask, I've shown you a comparison between here and here. What about the low temperature regime, where it's surprising that you seem to be recovering the spin liquid? But that seems to be consistent with what you see. You're able to burn holes out here. This is the hole depth as a percent of the available spins. And you can do that here. You get to this funny intervening phase. You're not able to burn holes. And then at low temperature, you're able to burn holes again. You have another axis on this phase diagram. And you might use this again to ask, what about the spin liquid state up here going as I apply a magnetic field towards the antiferromagnetic state? What can I learn now about these sorts of competing orders from the nonlinear susceptibility? And what you see is small fields really do something. This is now the zero field response at 100 millikelvin, right in the middle of that domed state. And now I put on 5 Gauss and 10 Gauss, and you can see I recover the sort of shape I had before. And in fact, is hole burning possible? Yes, it is. The minute you put on a small field now, you're able to all of a sudden burn these holes. So you really seem to go back into the fluid state. And you can map this out, this hole depth now for small field starts. Here you have a correlation as you put on the DC field. You can drill out bigger and bigger holes. And then as you approach the antiferromagnetic state, you seem to come out of the spin liquid crossover and no longer be able to burn out these holes anymore. So this technique now, which again you can calculate from a Brillouin fit, is hundreds of spins oscillating back and forth, is extremely sensitive to where you're sitting in the phase boundary and tells you about the sort of short-range correlations and the ability, in fact, to move yourself around. So in conclusion, I hope I've shown you that nonlinear dynamics, and here I'm talking about nonlinear dynamics at tiny fields, you know, half a gauss, is a sensitive avenue of study of spin liquids, that you can establish coherent collective modes of excitation that correspond to clusters of hundreds of spins that are labeled by their frequency. So you don't have to divide up the system spatially by lithography and all. You can pluck out different parts of the system just by this frequency label, because it's a bunch of harmonic oscillators, basically. I think there are opportunities in these phase diagrams for looking at quantum melting transitions in lithium, holmium, fluoride. As I said, as you increase the spin concentration up to 17%, you're well into a spin glass phase. So maybe this is a backdoor way now of looking at the onset of spin glass order from the spin liquid. Similarly, with magnetic field in the GGG, you can get out of whatever this ordered phase is into the spin liquid and then into a long-range antiferromagnet. And finally, there's some possibility of manipulation and entanglement using a transverse field. That is, we know that in lithium, holmium, fluoride, the state is stabilized by the quantum fluctuations. We know that the entanglement, if you will, is essential to being able to fit the data in a simulation. What we haven't shown is that the excitations can be entangled. If you can, of course, then you can do computations with them. And this goes back to the question of an external applied field. I mean, the hope is then, instead of using the random internal fields, that you would apply a uniform field. And I can show you some preliminary work, not on the excitations, but on the states themselves. So this is, again, the 110 millikelvin data for the lithium, holmium, fluoride, yttrium fluoride. This is the zero field data you've seen in the blue. You put on a kilo-Oersted, a kilogauss. You see now this is scaled. You move the peak up, but if you scale it back to compare the shapes, you see you broaden this out. That's the purple. You broaden it out just like temperature. It's just like raising a temperature, although it's a quantum knob, not a classical knob. But if you sit somewhere in between, the state can't decide which one it wants to go into. So it starts out coming down this trajectory and crosses over to that trajectory. So perhaps there's some hope of being able to actually mix states using the external field. Thanks.
I have several questions, but I'll ask only one. That's about this quantum computing connection, because
yes.
I don't think I followed that very well, because that part you didn't expand on. So this will have all the advantages and the disadvantages of liquid state ensemble quantum computing of NMR, right?
Yes, except these are electronic spins, not nuclear spins,
right.
So making coupling many bits. If you could couple any bits,
right.
Let me put the caveat in, but then the interaction range is huge. So in principle, one could couple many,
many bits. But you still will have the problem
scale
with the initialization, though, right? I mean, the reason on some, you know, NMR quantum computing, yeah, basically died, although it's, you know, it was ahead of everybody, is that there is no initialization. So, I mean, essentially, it's, you know, one is stuck with these few qubits. After that, one doesn't know how to do that. Is that problem here or not? That's what I'm trying to understand.
You can drill out as many qubits as you can fit. Mm-hmm. On that spectrum. So you can create 50 qubits.
Okay.
So that's not a problem.
Okay, so that's the limit. The limit is whatever that number
right.
is.
Right. Okay. But we have shown, let me be quite clear, we have no evidence that we can couple those excitations.
Oh, okay.
We know they're coherent for a long period of time, but we don't know how to make them talk together. In fact, right now they seem to be very nicely independent.
Okay.
because I can actually, in the absence of any external perturbation, I can drill out, say, a hole at 5 hertz and at 7 hertz, mm-hmm. and I can watch them decay, and they decay separately. I don't see any mixing between them.
I mean, the coupling that you're expecting is some kind of multipolar coupling in the end, right?
Well, I'm hoping that the transverse field will somehow, an external field, will then mix the states. That's correct. But this is clearly in the realm of speculation.
Do you have an idea of what drives the cluster size in these materials? Well, it's limited to a few hundred spins only.
Well, it's actually the fact that it's a few hundred spins, I sort of come from the other side thinking that's pretty good because it's a pretty disordered system. So, I mean, I think one of the nice... Oh, no, in GGG it's not disordered, that's correct. The fact that that's of order, the temperature perhaps is somehow related. I don't know. That's a good question. No, well,
the question is whether you could see changes in the cluster size
with temperature. We can certainly kill it with temperature, that's for sure. Because you just thermally excite it out. So I'm not sure I can answer the question in a reasonable fashion. I mean, one thing I found attractive about this was that, I mean, this at least shows that these sorts of excitations don't depend on the fact that the system is perfect. Right? I mean, this is a highly disordered system in the case of the lithium homium fluoride, GGG, you have a good point, it's not. And yet you're still able to get this sort of ensemble of excitations and many hundreds of spins acting coherently for a long time. So I thought, you know, for a solid state system, that's a plus. I hadn't thought about getting more spins in it, but.
So I'm just trying to understand the picture. It seems like, are you saying that when one sees some fractional exponent in the susceptibility as a function of temperature, that's likely the place where one can actually burn these holes in the nonlinear response?
Well, it's somewhat like asking the question is, you know, if you clip an elephant's toenails, do you keep it out of trees? Mm-hmm. Yes, it works, but is it really cause and effect? In lithium homium fluoride, yes. I'm not sure I've established a general sort
of picture. Actually, I was just wondering, suppose one gets to some quantum critical point where some susceptibilities, magnetic susceptibility, does show fractional exponent, whether it would be interesting to actually look at this kind of nonlinear effect.
I agree. I think the fact that near a quantum critical point you have fluctuations on large length scales is very promising and is very promising region to look for these sorts of effects. I agree.
I guess I was confused about something. The long times are the recovery of these holes. But do we know that there's really not, I mean, that things remain phase coherent over that long time? I didn't understand that.
So the experiment I'm doing, is turning off the pump, looking at a lock-in with fixed phase, and seeing if I get any signal. Right, so I'm setting the phase when I first drive the system. I'm now shutting off the excitation and looking for the amplitude, but also looking at the phase of the response. So if it's wandering off phase, what I would see is the signal would then die in a non-exponential manner, presumably. But I got a nice exponential fall off.
So you showed this plot relating frequency to cluster size somehow. Can you, if you extrapolate that to low frequencies, can you translate this into something like heat capacity, if you think that these clusters are non-interacting, into heat capacity as a function of temperature? Because that's one of the striking features of these frustrated spin liquids.
Okay, so this is the heat capacity. The heat capacity looks very different, although you can model it in the same way. So I'm sorry, these labels are horrible. This is the heat capacity versus temperature. This is on a linear scale between a tenth of a Kelvin and 8/10 of a Kelvin. This is the data. You see now you have sharp features in the data. So this is the equilibrium one, so I can't answer directly. Let me tell you what this is and then let me come back. This is now, if I calculate classically, simulate classically with the pairwise decimation, what I get, and you see features in the wrong places, but if I put in the full quantum splitting of the levels, this comes out, and these peaks now are sort of release of entropy at various parts as I come in looking at the various preferred sites where they're going to be dipolar interactions. The amazing thing actually is that the susceptibility doesn't show this. Now you're asking about what happens if I drive the system nonlinear and make the heat capacity measurements at that point. I mean, when I burn something.
I was just asking about the linear properties.
Okay, so this is the linear. So this is what it looks like. And this is dominated by the discrete features, which have to do also with kind of two-level system type behavior. So in that fashion, it gives you some additional information.
And if you've got a power law for the inverse susceptibility.
Yes.
That means that you've got correlations on all length scales, because if you just have local correlations, that would just give you a power law, would it?
I mean, the calculation is a pairwise one, so the length scale can be on all length scales, but only deals with two pairs of spins, and where you get the number of spins is a function of temperature that frees out. That's right, but there's no restriction on a particular length scale, but there is a restriction on how many spins you're talking about.
Other questions?
So I was just wondering what happened in the anti-glass. Are you still able to burn holes in the anti-glass?
Oh, yes, that's what I was showing you. The anti-glass is the 4.5%.
The same as the spin liquid.
That's the spin liquid, yes, that's right.
More general question. You talk about several different phases, spin liquid, spin glass, paramagnet distinct from spin liquid, and glassy magnetic phases. Now, I mean, are these distinctions just operational? One does an experiment, something that should be won over a narrow range of temperature. The range you showed was very narrow, 0.8 and so on. And so it's considered to be a different phase. Which is fine. I mean, those are operational definitions. Are these really distinct phases based on rather rigorous, experimentation?
In GGG, In GGG, that phase diagram, I'm not sure exactly how to think about it. So let me. I'm confused about what the order state is. So this is the putative phase diagram, okay? Clearly, this state and this state is well-defined. The point I was making that this is not a simple spin glass state, and to be frank, I don't know what this little, there seems to be something different here. I don't know what it is, okay? In lithium homium fluoride, though, the phase diagram I was talking about, the different regimes have to do with the number of dipoles. And in fact, they are distinct phases, and they operate over a full temperature range, but they are defined by the number of dipoles you have. So if you have a concentrated lattice, you just have a ferromagnet, nothing particularly interesting. If you have down to 30 or 40% of the sites occupied, you still have long-range order, but you have long-time relaxation because you get all these tangled domain walls, and actually in transverse field is much more interesting in the quantum limit. But we won't go there. But the system, of course, has a nice thing that if you put on enough external transverse field, you can drive any of these transitions to zero and look at this quantum phase transition in the same system as the classical phase transition. And Gabe and I have spent years doing that. If you now go to this point where you kill the long-range order by dilution, you can still get a frozen state, which is a spin glass state, has canonical divergence of chi-3, all that, no problem. If you dilute farther, these quantum fluctuations become more important, and you get into this spin glass or spin liquid state. And then if you go really dilute, and the French have worked on this, Bernard Barbara and colleagues, then you get to be a state like manganese 12. That is, the dipoles basically don't talk to each other, long-range collective interactions, but some neighbors do, and the hyperfine coupling with the nucleus becomes very important, and you see actual relaxations which are step-like in the magnetization. So, but all of those are separate physical states that aren't just a pocket in temperature, but an actual state defined by the concentration of the dipole. GGG is different, what I was talking about. I just wanted to make that distinction.
I had one question, actually,
yeah,
about the...
Sure.
To what extent I should take seriously the number of spins you associate with a cluster. In lithium, holmium, fluoride, maybe that's quasi-serious in the sense I can think of the spins as having somewhat ferromagnetic interactions.
Right.
But in GGG, whatever local clusters would form, it's hard to see why I can think of them as sort of well-aligned large moments.
And you also have, I mean, they're also predominantly anti-ferromagnetic coupled, so
right.
Why do you get that? In lithium, holmium, the evidence we use, and I just want to be clear about what's the experiment and what's the theory. The experiment is that we have a magnetization versus H amplitude of the field. We fit it to a Brillouin fit, and that's how we derive a number of spins. Now, the only other thing I would say is, given the fact that you're using tiny fields, you know, half Gauss fields, if you believe that the energy scale has to be of order the temperature, I think you're forced into concluding that there are a bunch of spins. Now, if it's somehow on the tail of the distribution and some sort of resonant thing where you have fewer spins, I mean, I have no theory for that, but you can imagine them seeing that as well.
Or you could imagine the clusters are actually even bigger with a small net moment.
Ah, yes, yes. No, that's certainly... Well, which we get back to the suggestion here. You're absolutely right. We're talking about a net moment and just assuming that each spin is contributing ferromagnetically. You're absolutely right. It could be much bigger in that fashion. Yeah.
Any more questions? Okay. Well, let's thank both speakers again.
Okay.